Welcome in, podcast listeners. This is your last chance to go give us 5 stars before Danny G reads all the podcast reviews. He is going to find out who gave the best 5-star reviews. This is your last chance, so please go give us a 5-star review. We have got a loaded show for you in the first hour. Baylor men's basketball coach Scott Drew. In the second hour, how about John Morosi, our Major League Baseball insider? And then in hour number 3, Petros Papadakis, AM 570, LA Sports, the Petros and Money Show. All of that rolling your direction. We talk the latest on Deshaun Watson. We talk soccer super leagues and what that would look like if it came to college football. All that and more. It's Outkick, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern live, but you get the podcast at your leisure, and it begins now.
Outkick the coverage with Clay Travis live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
We've got a lot to dive into, but I want to start with the Deshaun Watson story, which I think we now have got some interesting angles at play here. And the NFL draft is, whatever it is, 9 days away. And we probably are going to have 5 quarterbacks in the first round, maybe 6. And one of the challenging things going forward is always trying to project what's going to happen with quarterbacks, whether they're going to perform or not perform. And that's almost always on the field. And here, this Deshaun Watson story is really kind of blowing my mind here over the direction that these cases are going. Let me explain what I mean. Rusty Hardin is Deshaun Watson's lawyer. There have been 22 women who have now named themselves in the complaints and alleged that Deshaun Watson sexually assaulted them. And there is also a simultaneous criminal investigation in addition to these civil lawsuits where charges could or could not be brought against Deshaun Watson. It remains to be seen. But Deshaun Watson has now said publicly through Rusty Hardin, his attorney, all 22 of these women are liars. And I don't understand that legal perspective at all. That is a tough spot. That is a tough putt to sink if you are the lawyer here. And it also, to me, makes it more difficult to settle this case. Because as soon as you call all 22 of these women liars, and you are saying effectively that all of these women have made it up, that anything that went on between the two of you was consensual, that nothing you did was even inappropriate at all, and all of these women are lying, it makes it hard to settle the case. I'm not saying it's impossible to settle these cases. I'm just saying when you accuse someone of lying, there are probably some of these women and some of these women's family members now that are going to say, wait a minute, he has called you out as a liar, and then you're going to allow him to settle this case with you? There's not a good resolution to this situation to me now. Because if Deshaun Watson ends up actually settling these cases, then everybody's going to say, wait a minute, you said these women were lying. Why would you give them any money at all? And if you are these women, how do you settle with Deshaun Watson when he's accused you of lying? Because now it's difficult for Deshaun Watson to say, oh, I said those women were lying, but now I'm going to give them some money and we're going to just pretend that I never said they were lying. Like, this situation, I find it to be a really difficult situation for Deshaun Watson because I don't see how it gets resolved quickly now. And so Deshaun Watson basically said, hey, these women are lying. I didn't behave inappropriately, through his attorney, Rusty Hardin. And then Tony Busby, who is the plaintiff's attorney for these 22 women, came out and said, this is a direct quote, as fully anticipated and despite his lawyer's previous statements, Deshaun Watson's only defense is to call these brave women liars. The weak and vague allegations made in defendant's response are demonstrably false. Watson can't deny he sought out an unusually high number of women for massages on Instagram. He doesn't. He doesn't deny he insisted on being nude or nearly nude. He can't deny the massage sessions occurred. He can't deny he wanted more than a massage. And he hasn't credibly denied that something bad happened during the session. He instead claims that any sexual acts were consensual. Of course, his definition of consent doesn't comport with that of everyone else. I have faith that the court process will sort out the truth as these matters progress. The problem for Deshaun Watson is he doesn't gain anything by this process taking a long time. And I got to be honest with you, I don't understand his legal defense at this point in time. Because if I were advising Deshaun Watson, this is me putting on my lawyer hat, I would tell him, settle, settle, settle. You could have settled this for $100,000 when the first woman came to you and said, hey, I was mistreated. We would have never seen her story go public. $100,000 is a rounding error to Deshaun Watson, who has a $156 million contract extension that he just agreed to and makes tens of millions of dollars elsewhere, probably through endorsements and everything else at that point in time. So the idea that you wouldn't have in the first place paid $100,000 to settle these cases, and let me be honest with you, I understand if you feel like you did nothing wrong, why you wouldn't want to just give somebody $100,000. But the negative publicity attendant with this first woman going public and saying that you sexually assaulted her cost you more than $100,000 in the court of public opinion. So I would have advised Deshaun Watson when this first woman went public, I would have been like, hey, we need to think about settling this case. Because she wanted $100,000, she might have taken $50,000, which is nothing to Deshaun Watson. And then if this woman doesn't go public, a lot of these other women probably wouldn't go public either. And I would have said, if I was Deshaun Watson's attorney, hey, no more massages, dude. You are putting yourself in a rough spot when you lock a door, when you're behind a closed door with one other woman. There's nothing good that can come out of this from you. These are not therapeutic massages. Let's stop pretending otherwise. You are interested in this being something more than a therapeutic massage. You're a starting quarterback in the NFL in a fabulous city in Houston, Texas. If you want women, there's not hardly any man in America who has access to more women than you do. This idea that you're going to be trying to meet them and engage in sexual activity through massages, then it's not going to work, buddy. You're just not going to do that, all right? So that's the advice that I would have given him if I was a lawyer. And by the way, one reason you pay lawyers is so they will tell you things that might be uncomfortable. You sometimes hear lawyers say, hey, I got to have a come to Jesus meeting with my client. I'm going to sit him down and I'm going to tell him what's up and the risk that he's running. And if he doesn't take my advice, that's fine. But I'm not in the yes man business. Good lawyer isn't a yes man. A good lawyer challenges you. He or she advises you the best decisions that you can make. You don't need another yes man if you are a star athlete. There are tons of people out there who will tell you exactly what they think you want to hear. The more successful you become, the more people who surround you telling you how awesome you are, the chorus of you're awesome becomes pretty extensive when there are a lot of people who rely on you to pay their bills. And so you need a lawyer, you need an agent, you need somebody to talk truth to you when a lot of people want. And so if I were Deshaun Watson's lawyer right now, I'd be saying, this is an awful road that you are going down. You are putting yourself in a position where you're painting yourself into a corner. You're calling all 22 of these women liars. I got to be honest with you. I've never been in a case where 22 different women all told the same lie. Maybe they are. Maybe Deshaun Watson is the victim here and he's done absolutely nothing inappropriate. But 22 different women calling them liars, that's the exact opposite of what you need to be doing. You need to be trying to settle this case so you can get back to playing football. Calling them liars is going to prolong this, making them put their names in the lawsuits. You are creating abundant amounts of antagonism. And when two sides really don't like each other in an adversarial process, sometimes people stop making the smartest decision and start making the one that's going to make the other side the angriest. This is why in divorces, you never want it to drag into court, because sooner or later, people stop making the rational decision and they start making the choice that's designed to make the other side the angriest. And I think this is going in a really awful direction for Deshaun Watson. I don't understand his legal strategy. He needs to settle immediately, even if it costs him tens of millions of dollars now. He didn't need to call these women liars. He has painted himself into an indefensible corner.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Joined now by a national champion head coach, Scott Drew of Baylor University. And does that get old to hear? And did you really ever believe you would hear it? I know what you said. Does it still feel a little bit like a surreal universe that you hear that now, Coach?
Well, it's only been about 2 weeks, but I could get used to this. So, yeah, I love hearing that. And it's a great honor and recognition for the players and what they were able to achieve. And as a coach, it's kind of like a parent. On Christmas Day, when you see your kids opening up a present and everybody's excited, you're happy. And to see all Baylor Nation, Central Texas, Waco, the state of Texas, only our second basketball championship. The last one they did a movie on in 1966. So, exciting time in Texas right now.
Okay, so I want to take you back before we go to the national championship game. When you took over in 2003, we came on the day after you win the championship and say, this is not just a remarkable story for basketball. This is one of the all-time accomplishments. I'm trying to do it off the top of my head. I knew all the data. Uh-huh. You'll probably know them better than me. I think since 1950, Baylor had been to the NCAA tournament once in 1988. When you took over, you were on probation. Many people know about the awful incident, the murder that was involved in Baylor basketball. Did you, when you took over in 2003, and I think it took you 4 years to get to a winning record, did you ever have doubts and think maybe this is not going to work? Take me back to 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, before everything really starts to get rolling and you start at least making the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, great question. So I can equate this to anyone that's opened a new business or restaurant, and you are so busy in the beginning doing what you're doing, you don't have time to get too frustrated or upset because you're moving on to the next issue or the next problem. So with us, we get to campus and we only have between 5 and 7 scholarship players throughout the year because academically we had some guys out at different times. So the first thing we had to do was go all over campus and try to find at least half a team full of walk-ons that can fill our roster. Now, talk about a great deal. Not only could you walk on, but you actually could play. So, I mean, that was pretty good. So we have our opening tryout. We have a lot of people show up. And you know what? We walked out of the gym. We're like, dang, there's some good-looking athletes. We got some height. We call everyone over, and we ask, all right, so what year are you at Baylor? Where do you live? And all of a sudden, a hand goes up and says, wait a minute, you got to go to school at Baylor to be on the team? We're like, yeah. So hence, people that drove down from Dallas, from the junior colleges and all over Central Texas thinking they could be on the team without going to school. Most of them left. We were left with what's normal, the 6-foot walk-off. And we filled out our roster that way. That year, we actually won 3 conference games, did not finish last, so it was a blessing. And then the next year was really tough. It was more the rebuilding year because it was too late to bring in any recruits because when we took over, most of them had already committed. And then the third year was when the NCAA actually took away our non-conference schedule. So that was when the penalties all came down, so we just played a regular season. We're the only school to ever do that, by the way.
Yeah,
so
if that's anyone wild. Ever's in that, I looked at your coaching record, and I was like, what in the world happened that year? I had to go back and research it that you only played conference basketball.
Yeah, so if anyone's ever in that situation, we're the only ones with experience, so we can help you with that. But I can tell you what was so hard with that is imagine practicing all the way from August until January, basically. And then when you play, you're expecting to have the success, and then you're terrible because it's kind of like a freeway. You know, in Texas, speed limit 75, everybody's zooming, and now you're getting on the ramp at conference play, and you're going 40, 50, 60, trying to catch up. So that was a tough year. And then the next year, what's amazing, 5 years later, you make the NCAA tournament. And that was the story in itself because we were the last team called. So we had a big celebration party. The Farrell Center's packed on the floor. So we got all these people here, and we get through the whole bracket, and they're down to one team to be called. And I never in my wildest dreams thought we weren't going to be called because Joe Lunardi said we were in. You know, and if he says you're in, right? Yeah, so Joey Brackett says we're good, and all of a sudden you're thinking, if they don't call us, what are we telling everybody? And then we're the last name called. The place erupts. We get in the NCAA tournament. Then we go to two Elite Eights, 2010, 2012, and God's plan's always perfect because I'd have had us go to the Final Four then, but you know, then you don't appreciate it as much, and you know, and you don't realize what a blessing it is when you do make it to a Final Four. And then obviously we won the national championship this year.
What does it feel like to lose an Elite Eight game?
Well, not only is it tough to lose, but then you got to watch that team cut down nets, celebrate. And in both instances for us, Duke ended up winning the national championship in 2010, and Kentucky won it in 2012. So you're sitting there thinking, man, we could have won a national championship. And,
right.
And that when you get, like, you make it to the Sweet 16, you have a full week to enjoy it, and you get a lot of media attention. When you make it to the Final Four, you have a full week to enjoy it and a lot of media attention. So losing the Elite Eight is really hard because, you know, most college coaches, their goal and dream is always to be in the Final Four. Most players, their dream is to be in a Final Four, to be that close and not get there. And that's why when we got there this year, it was that much more of a blessing because our staff realized how hard it is to get there.
When did you start to realize and make recruits aware of Baylor as a viable option? So I know you mentioned early on you're not even able, you get the probation, you're not able to play an out-of-conference. When was there a moment when you went into a home or you talked to some recruits and you started thinking, okay, we're starting to get a little bit of momentum, people know that we're a player on a relatively high level? Was there a moment like where it kind of shifted for you? Because you talked about it's like starting a business and it's so hard initially because, and there are a lot of people I'm sure listening to us who know what that's like because there's so many things that you're trying to fix simultaneously that you don't really have the time to be like, hey, here's my 5-year plan. Here's my 3-year plan.
Right.
You're like, I just got to get through today. I got to get through this week. When do you start being able to plan and build and think, okay, we're starting to get a little bit of a foundation and recruits are becoming aware of us?
Well, we were able to attract some good recruits early on. Aaron Bruce from Australia was a freshman All-American. Mamadou Gien was a 7-footer from Senegal, and he was our first recruit. But really, it was that year, that third year, when we brought in Curtis Gerrals from Austin, who was highly touted, and then Henry Dugat from Houston that was highly touted, and Kevin Rogers from Dallas that was highly touted. So you get three recruits across the state that are all name recognized, worthy, and high level players to where, wait a minute, they're going to Baylor. So if they're going to Baylor, I need to consider Baylor. And that recruiting class in the state of Texas kind of got us going. And then we brought in our first McDonald's All-American in Tweedy Carter. And then from there, the program kind of just grew because since 2008, only Kansas and us in the Power Five have won 18 or more games a year. And in the last 5 years, only us, Kansas, Duke, and Gonzaga have been ranked in the top, have been ranked number one 3 of the last 5 seasons or more. So we've had success since 2008. We've had elite success in the last couple of years, and we're the winningest team in the Power Five in the last 2 years. A lot of success, and obviously COVID didn't allow us to have a chance to go to a Final Four last year or play in the NCAA tournament, which made everybody appreciate it that much more this year.
You won the national championship this year. Would you consider this to be your best coaching job, or do you think one of those other years where you didn't have the same success at the end of the season was your best coaching job?
That's another great question. What I would tell you is we ask our players to improve every year, and I'm hoping our coaching staff does the same thing. So hopefully I'm better now than I was several years ago, and hopefully next year I'm better than I was this year. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the goal.
If you could go back to 2003 and talk to yourself, what do you think you know to that extent? You're getting a little bit better, hopefully, every year at what you do. And I imagine a lot of people out there listening to us right now try to do that in their own profession. What do you think would have been the most interesting and helpful bit of advice you could have given yourself in 2003 that you had no clue about now, but you have come to learn in the ensuing 18 years?
Man, you're asking some deep questions today. I would probably, first of all, I would have probably said enjoy having hair because it's going to come out real quick in the next couple of years. So that's number one, all right? The other thing is, as we get older, life really speeds up. And I would, looking back, I wish I'd spent a little more time with my kids when they were little, to be honest. And you spend so much time working and you spend so much time trying to build a program. And next thing you know, I got a 17-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 10-year-old. My wife's done an amazing job because she's been there most of the time when I've been traveling and gone. But probably enjoy that time a little bit more. And I'd have probably scheduled a little bigger break during Christmas time so that you could spend a little more time with the family. That's something.
That's good advice, I think, for a lot of people with young kids. In fact, I'm coaching and have been coaching a lot with kids, and it's interesting because as you get older, the college kids seem younger, right? I'm sure when you started coaching in 2003, you felt a little bit more like a contemporary to them. Now you just said you got a 17-year-old. I'm sure you look at them very much as your own kids. And so I'm curious from a coaching perspective. College basketball season is extremely long. This year with COVID, it was even more crazy than it ordinarily would be. How do you balance out when to go hard on them, when to go soft on them? And in particular, when you were dealing with the COVID shutdown you guys had and you had to miss some games, and then you came back and you weren't necessarily playing at your peak level, how do you hit the right note to get them playing at a peak level by the time the tournament comes around?
Well, so
is it art or science in your mind, I guess, from a coaching perspective?
Some of it is your feel, and some of it is your experience on your team. Like with us, this was a player-led team. We had a lot of experienced players that were veterans, that were professionals. And what I mean by that is they came into the gym and they wanted to get better. They wanted to be pushed. Other times you have a more inexperienced team that are more your freshmen and sophomores, and there you tend to have less consistency. So you have more ups and downs, and there you gotta keep them fresher because the grind of the season will wear them out a lot quicker than a 22, 23-year-old who's used to it. So with us, I can tell you that I'm energetic. Our staff's energetic. We want it to, when you come into the gym, you're excited to be in the gym. Not, oh gosh, I gotta get yelled at for the next 2 or 3 hours today. We want guys that want to come in the gym. They want to get better. And at the same time, we try to make it fun because we spend most of our time with them in the gym. So as far as when you're hard on them, when you're not, I think it's a consistency they want. And with us, I mean, when they screw up, we're going to hold them accountable, but it's not a demeaning thing. It's a corrective thing that they should want to get better. And the accountability part's really more than anything, because with this generation, it's not telling them what you know. It's telling them why they need to know it. Because if they understand the importance of it, they're going to do it 100%. And sometimes, as coaches, we just think you tell them to do this and they got to do this without explaining why they got to do it. So we're constantly trying to remind ourselves to explain the why so they can buy in with it.
We're talking to Baylor men's basketball coach Scott Drew, now a national champion coach. Last year, when suddenly the rug gets pulled out from underneath your team, you had a really good team last year too. What did that feel like for your team when suddenly the NCAA tournament is no more?
Well, I tell you, the coaches I talked to all had the same feeling, and that is, you think about it, most college kids aren't going to be in the NBA. Most college kids spend most of their young life working for an opportunity to reach the top, the platform, and that is the pinnacle is the NCAA tournament. And like for our seniors, Freddie Gillespie that didn't get a chance, Devontae Bandu who didn't get a chance, we had a walk-on Obim that didn't get a chance to play in it. I mean, your heart goes out to them. It's one of the toughest things that us coaches had to do, saying that there is no NCAA tournament. Now, the blessing for us, most of our guys came back, and they all remembered that feeling of not having an opportunity last year. So we were all that much more excited for this year, and that's why we couldn't thank the NCAA enough for having the bubble and making it a safe environment, which we could play the NCAA tournament. And I know the restrictions are not what everyone's used to, but we were just so excited to be in the bubble and wanted to stay in the bubble and be a part of March Madness, because when we didn't have the opportunity the year before, we really were blessed and appreciative of it this year. And again, this is a memory that lasts a lifetime, and especially for a lot of people that this is the end of their basketball career, because most people don't play professional basketball.
We're talking to Baylor national champion coach Scott Drew. So when you finish and beat Houston, and you have a 48-hour window basically to turn around and get ready for the national championship game, did you watch the game between Gonzaga and UCLA? Were you scouting it? What is I'm fascinated by that window, that quick turnaround. Had you already scouted everything else during the course of that week, so you didn't really have much to do? You win, you know you're in the national championship game. Your life looks like what for the next 48 hours?
So, first of all, most staffs you break down, and one coach will have the team you're playing as a scout, and then the other two coaches will take – one will take UCLA, one will take Gonzaga, and then once you know who's you're playing, well, that person has most of the scout done, maybe 80% of it done, and then they add what they saw in the last game played. With me, what I tend to do is, like, synergy breaks everything down. You can watch them against zone, you can watch them against man, the press offense, press defense. And to me, I'm not going to waste time watching a game live, because there's too many interruptions and it takes too long.
Yeah.
So right away, you're starting to focus on your team first. So I wanted to watch our game versus Houston, see where we could get better, how we could improve. And then once I knew who we were playing, then start to watch all those breakdowns and then watch the last game they played, because obviously you can fast forward all the dead periods. So now it becomes a 40-minute game instead of a two-hour game. And when you have a small window, it's important not to waste time.
So how nervous are you, and what would you say of your team's overall perspective and persona as you walk out and get ready to play on that Monday?
Well, it's different in the bubble from the standpoint when you go to a game and there's only 10% or 25%, it's nothing like when there's 100% and fans are all over
right,
and so much louder. By that time of the year, we had actually gotten pretty used to being in venues that were 10% full or 25% full. So it was a lot easier to keep your players' attention, because normally in an NCAA tournament, you play two rounds, you come back to campus, campus is going crazy, everybody's trying to congratulate them, and then you're not able to practice as much because you're traveling, so that affects your time to practice. Where when you're in the bubble, I mean, you come back, and how you celebrate it, you go to the team room with your team. So it's real simple. You eat, you get up the next day, you watch some film, you get ready for practice, and you can really keep their attention, and you're able to really do a lot more. So you're not overwhelmed by the national championship game as you might be, I guess, in a normal situation with us. We were set to play Gonzaga on December 5th, had so much respect for Coach Few and his team, and then that game got canceled, and we were disappointed at that time because it was 1-2, but you know what? God had a better plan. He said, we ain't going to do this on December 5th. We're going to do this on April 5th. And Coach Few and I agreed. We said, if we meet back here and make this game on April 5th, we are good with that. And that's what ended up happening. And they had an unbelievable season. And Coach Few is a Hall of Fame coach, does a tremendous job. But I know we had a bunch of guys that are competitors, and they want to play against the best. So they were excited to play against Gonzaga.
How did you – I know you celebrated with your team. You're in Indianapolis. I saw the footage of everything that happened on Baylor. I guess they were out on the football field, storming the football field and everything else, having an incredible time watching you guys play. What was it like to finally return to campus, having won the national championship? As you mentioned, you guys were in the bubble at Indianapolis. And what has it been like in the state of Texas since you returned?
So the game finishes, we're able to see our families, and that was such a blessing because for the last 3-4 weeks we hadn't been able to since we got to Indianapolis, and actually in the Big 12 tournament we were in a bubble, so not able to give hugs and see our little ones. But once the game was over, you spent time with family, and after about 3-4 in the morning, you go back to your hotel room, and then you got your 1,000-plus text messages, and right away you start to try to answer those, and then the next thing is you got the morning shows. So why would you fall asleep for 30 minutes or an hour? You know, you haven't pulled an all-nighter since you were 30 years ago in college, so you might as well stay awake now. So then you finish that in the morning shows, and then you leave to come back. You land. There's a big gathering at the airport for you. You're excited about that. You go home. You crash that night. And then ever since then, you get up and you have opportunities to talk to great people like you and your show and everybody else across America and brag about your guys. And it doesn't get much better than that because what they achieved this year is remarkable and special. First championship in Baylor history. And like you said, first Big 12 championship since 1950, first Final Four since 1950 as well.
Baylor men's basketball coach, national champion, Scott Drew. I know how busy you have been, Coach. I appreciate you coming on with us early this morning, and we look forward to talking to you again somewhere down the line.
Sounds great. Take care. Thank you for all you do.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Hey, I'm Doug Gottlieb. The podcast is called All Ball. We usually talk all basketball all the time, but it's more about the stories about what made these people love their sport and all the interesting interactions along the way. We talk to coaches. We talk to players. We tell you stories. You download it. You listen to it. I think you'll like it. Listen to All Ball with Doug Gottlieb on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Man. Positive energy there, obviously, from Scott Drew, and I think you would have to have an incredible amount of positive energy to take over a job like he did in the depths of probation and despair, let's be honest, from a college basketball program, and build them over the space of 18 years back up to the championship caliber team they were, and then to win a championship there is it's a pretty remarkable and incredible story from top to bottom, and appreciate him coming on with us early and breaking all that down. He was fantastic. Also, want to mention this. So we started off the show talking about Deshaun Watson and the legal case that is out there involving him. Want to give you a roadmap of where we're headed a bit more. We're scheduled to be joined by John Morosi in the second hour of the program, and then Petros Papadakis in the third hour. But this European soccer story, I know we don't spend a lot of time probably like, what are you talking about, Clay? This European soccer. This is a wild story. And the analogy that I would make that I think will connect with a lot of you out there is this is roughly akin to many of the biggest college football programs in the country suddenly deciding that they were not going to focus on their conferences anymore, and they were instead going to be part of a larger conglomerate competing for a championship for tons of money at stake, right? A little bit different. So you have soccer is the sport of choice, right, in Europe, in England, in Germany, in Italy, and in France. The biggest soccer clubs dominate the sporting landscape in those countries. And the biggest and best teams compete in the Champions League, but basically these teams now are saying we're so good that we are going to create our own pro soccer super league, and that super soccer league, we're going to guarantee over $400 million a year to each of these teams, and we're not going to care as much about the local leagues that we are in. Now, still, it matters to win the EPL or Serie A or whatever, La Liga in Spain, like whatever all these different organizations are. But in essence, what they are saying is we as a group are more valuable than we would be as a part of our own soccer federation in the country, and we're going to pull out. And it's the equivalent of, let's say, if Ohio State and Michigan had said, hey, why in the world are we giving Rutgers and Maryland money in football? And it would be the equivalent of like Alabama and let's say Georgia and Florida and Tennessee, which are four of the most lucrative programs in the SEC, saying, hey, why do Vanderbilt and Mississippi State deserve to get the money that we're creating as these big brands? And so as a result going forward, you start to look at it and say, man, could something like this happen going forward in the world of college football, where suddenly everybody out there that is a part of these, the Big Ten or the SEC or the Big 12 or the Pac-12 or the ACC, what if all the biggest and most valuable programs, let's say the 25 biggest and best in each of those conferences, divorced itself from everybody else? And so you would have, let's say, in the Pac-12, and you know what I'll do at the top of the second hour? I'll kind of sketch out what this might look like just based off of revenue. But if you took the 25 biggest programs, you'd basically have your SC, your Oregon, maybe your Washington's in the Pac-12. In the Big 12, you'd have Texas and Oklahoma for sure. Maybe other programs associated with that as well. SEC has a lot of really big programs. Your Alabamas, your LSUs, your Auburns, your Tennessees, your Georgias, your Floridas. Those schools all make way more money than some of the other lesser schools. In the ACC, it would probably be Clemson for sure, Florida State, maybe Miami because of their history. In the Big Ten, you'd end up with Michigan. You'd end up with Ohio State, maybe Wisconsin. And you look at the overall revenues. Nebraska's a decent-sized program. And you roll all those together, and they start saying, hey, instead of playing in a four-team college football championship, we're going to play a massive super college football season, and we're all going to play against each other. But some of these smaller schools, the ones that produce substantially less revenue, it doesn't make sense for us to have a relationship in the same way with those schools anymore. That's effectively what the Super League in the Euros would represent. And at the top of the second hour, I'll talk a little bit more about that and whether I think anything such as that could ever occur. But if it did, you can imagine, if you thought realignment was a mess, this would be realignment on steroids. And I think the best analogy you can draw, again, is between the major soccer powers and the major college football powers. And I will lay that out a bit more for you to start off the second hour of the program. And also, we will then be joined by John Morosi to break down the latest in Major League Baseball. All that and more headed your direction. Appreciate all of you hanging out with us. This is OutKick, hour one in the books.